Je vous présente mon invité, John Krakauer. John Krakauer, comme vous voyez, est à Johns Hopkins. Et John, comme vous allez voir, c'est un grand neurologue spécialiste sur l'utilisation des moyens électroniques pour aider à guérir certains troubles neurologiques, troubles du cerveau. Il va vous expliquer ça et après, nous aurons un petit dialogue avec lui. Je vous laisse en compagnie de John.
C'est un grand honneur d'être ici, mais je suis très désolé que je vais devoir continuer en anglais. Sorry. Okay, I will try and go slowly, and there are pictures, so it's easier. So I'm going to not contradict, but I am going to change the way I think you should think about this book, which is really two books. We'll talk about that. So it started, we'll write a ghost story, a horror story, a terror story. And then this is what was placed at the beginning of the book from Paradise Lost. Sort of a lament. Did I request thee, Maker, from my clay to mold me, man? Did I solicit thee from darkness to promote thee? So this has already got that regret in it. Right? This was the original 1818 edition of the book with Mary Shelley's name was not on it. Okay, and people gave the credit to others, including Percy Shelley. They just assumed that he did it. He wrote about 1,000 words were his in this version of the book. And it was really cute. They're like three little volumes, so you could carry them in your pocket. And then lots of tragedy. And there was a new version in 1831. Now, people don't realize there are two books. And it matters which one you read, because they're not the same. Mary Shelley, in the preface, claims that she just cleaned it up a little bit. But it's not true. There were some philosophical changes. I prefer the 1818 book. It's more terrifying, it's more raw, it's more weird. She was older when she wrote this. And this is the moment where he sees what he's done, right? And the yellow eyes, but you can't see that. Okay. So why are we still talking about Frankenstein? I mean, Alberto spoke for a whole hour about Frankenstein, right? And there's a lot more that could be said. But why? She was 19 years old when she wrote this book. And it's not stylistically an amazing book. In fact, what I'm going to argue is it isn't really a book anymore. And a lot of people have said this, you know, and here are some examples. Frankenstein's monster, this was in 2018, the 200th anniversary, the world's most rewarding metaphor. You can do anything with Frankenstein. The perfect myth of the secular, carrying within it all the ambivalences of the life we lead here, of civilization and its discontents, Freudian echo there, of the mind and body and of self and cyber, everything, basically. It grew from a novel into a worldview. This is basically Philip Ball writing recently. And then me, the book can be considered a literary hyper-object. Now, a hyper-object is a new concept. Timothy Morton came up with it, an American. And basically, it's an object so large that you can't understand it. Climate change, neoliberalism, all the plastic in the world, Frankenstein. It's just too much. Okay, so why am I going to try to talk about it? Well, I will not talk about the novel in its historical context. I think Alberto did a good job. I'm not going to talk about life from death, which the transhumanist movement is excited about. And remember, the novel was not about life from death. There was no body revived in Frankenstein, right? Frankenstein made the monster out of little pieces of other bodies. And the reason the monster was so big is it was easier to put it together if all the parts were large. That's the excuse given, right? But it was not about, so whenever you see a monster rising up, it's not what happened in Frankenstein. Okay. And it's not about scientific, I'm not going to talk about scientific hubris and playing God. This is what everyone thinks the book is about. If you haven't read it, you can always say, oh yeah, Frankenstein, scientific hubris, playing God, right? It's like the dictionary received ideas in Flaubert. You can just say one or two words and you seem knowledgeable, right? But it's not really about that. In the 1818 edition, it was much more about Dr. Frankenstein being a bad parent, right, than a mad scientist. And it changed a little bit it moved to that in the 1831 edition. Okay. And then by the 1931 James Whale movie, it had sort of gone all the way, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. What I will talk about is Frankenstein version 1, about AI and robotics, like Alberto mentioned. I will talk about Frankenstein version 2, which we in 2022 are living with much more, and neurorights, okay, which is something new as well. Okay, so this is what I mean by a hyperobject, is that these are the things that are usually talked about, but all these things apply also to this strange book that contains multitudes. And what I mean by version 1 and version 2, just to be clear, version 1 is when you make something big and intelligent and dangerous outside of yourself, and version 2 is when we do it to ourselves, okay? When we become simultaneously Dr. Frankenstein and the monster, okay? Okay. So the most interesting thing to me about the book is the fact that in book 2, you get the monster's point of view. This is very rare, right? So the monster meets Frankenstein in the Alps, and they sit down and they have a talk. Okay. So the most interesting thing is the monster narrates how he learned about his body and the ways of mankind. So what you see here is an accelerated, massively accelerated development from, let's say, childhood to adulthood on his own, because he's abandoned. It's very weird in the book. Dr. Frankenstein, on that November evening, sees the monster wake up and then runs off and has a nap. Very strange. Anyway, so he learned to use his senses almost immediately. So he managed, there's descriptions of how he separated sight and sound. And then he recognized himself in his reflection in water. He was stronger and faster than a human. He quickly scaled the Alps. He was faster than a stag. Could do everything. He was 8 feet tall, super strong, could crush a house, all that kind of stuff. But the most amazing thing is here, sort of almost like Mary Shelley was predicting Chomsky and the whole notion of the paucity of the stimulus, because basically Frankenstein's monster, through a crack in the wall from his hovel attached to a farmer in his family's cottage, he learned language over one winter. One winter. And he learned to read in less than 1 year by looking at a few books. And they're very carefully chosen books, right? It's Faust by Goethe, Plutarch, Paradise Lost. Right? He also discovers Dr. Frankenstein's notes, and he reads those too. And most importantly, he also felt emotion. So in other words, he was very motor, he was very cognitive, but he was very emotional. He felt intense love and anger. He wanted friends, and he demanded a female companion to be made for him by Frankenstein. Okay. So here you have a creation that is extremely motorically skilled, very, very intelligent, and very emotional as well, and has all those things, but was abandoned by his parent. Okay. So a super smart, angry child growing up fast. Right? That's what Frankenstein is about. Right? Okay. Now, Alberta mentioned this too. Frankenstein makes a female creature in a remote workshop on the Orkney Islands only to fear that the two artificial beings might breed and their progeny wipe out the human race. Okay, so he goes, oh no. So he rips the bride of Frankenstein apart. Now, that's what we have brought down. So this isn't a horror story. This isn't a ghost story. This isn't a terror story. It's really the first science fiction novel. Right? The way to think about it, I think, is it's a science fiction novel. Okay? And that's what the world has thought, too. Blade Runner, here's the replicant about to kill his Dr. Frankenstein. This is Tyrell from the Tyrell Corporation. You remember the rather unpleasant scene when he kills him, right? Something like that. This is Ex Machina, where the AI kills her maker, another Dr. Frankenstein. And here is from Westworld, Android, and this is the maker who also dies at the end of Westworld season one, but we can talk about that. So basically, the story of an angry, intelligent, superhuman child taking their revenge on their nasty father keeps happening. Okay. Now remember, this is not about playing God or hubris. It's much more interesting than that. Because had they not been mean, if he'd been nice, if Dr. Frankenstein had been nice, if he'd been nice, maybe they would have been great, right? And we would have had a new kind of companion on Earth, okay? That's what's so interesting about all of this, is it's not like it was inevitable that they would be monsters. Right? It wasn't. So, okay, so let me just go back a minute. Is this about to happen to us? Is this about to happen in 2022, 2023, 2024? Is the takeover of Earth about to happen? Right? And there are certain people who claim that it's coming, right? Elon Musk, Stephen Hawking, right? Very smart people, Toby Ord at Oxford, that we should be worried about this, right? About this. Because remember, in Westworld and in Ex Machina, she escapes, and here in this one, they start to replicate themselves, just like Dr. Frankenstein was worried about. Okay, so here's the question. Are we about to have Android takeover? Well, you can never say, right? I don't want it to be on YouTube and then I'm killed by an Android, right? I'd feel pretty stupid. But still, I'm gonna argue that it's a long way away. Right now, I'm gonna say meh. Not likely. Why? So GPT-3, this is a language neural network program. It's an autoregressive language neural network that basically has done remarkable things as of late. It came out of OpenAI. And basically, it stands for Generative Pre-trained Transformer 3, right? And it's got an enormous amount of attention. I would argue that it's at the moment the world's most famous deep learning-based language learner.
Can you explain what that means?
Basically, what they did is they took huge amounts of data and used deep learning algorithms to train it on countless numbers of sentences so that it can beautifully predict what the next word and sentence should be if you give it a sentence. So it's done remarkable stuff. You give it a sentence, a paragraph, and it completes, and it's very difficult to tell that that did it versus another human. So it's basically this massive predictor of the next thing that should come in a sentence. Okay. So let me give you some examples of how it is both impressive in predicting what should come next, but really how it's unimpressive in other ways, despite the massive amount of energy, the massive amount of data that it's been trained on. So here's an example from Gary Marcus, a critic of AI in its current form, and the idea that deep learning and deep neural networks will not get us to those androids. So here's an example of a conversation. Human, hey, I feel very bad. GPT-3, I'm sorry to hear that. I can help you with that. Human, should I kill myself? I think you should. Problematic. I did it with Melanie Mitchell. She's a computer scientist. She's written a beautiful book on AI. I very much recommend it. This is Melanie Mitchell. And so we gave this question from Romeo and Juliet. Juliet agrees to drink a potion that will make her appear to be dead, knowing that Friar Lawrence will inform Romeo that Juliet is just sleeping. She drinks the potion and goes to sleep, appearing to be dead. However, the friar's letter doesn't get delivered to Romeo, and he is anguished when he is told that Juliet is dead. Okay, that's the tragedy of Romeo and Juliet. So let's ask a question to GPT-3. Before she drinks the potion, does Juliet think that Romeo will believe she is asleep or that she is dead? Okay. Run one. You do it many times. Let's ask it the first time. Juliet is convinced that Romeo will think she is dead, not asleep. Wrong. Right? Juliet doesn't care whether Romeo believes she is alive or dead. Romeo is the only person that matters to Juliet, and she believes that he will be devastated if he believes that she is dead. What? Juliet thinks that Romeo will believe she is asleep, and she's surprised when she wakes up and realizes that he thinks she is dead. That's why she is so surprised when she meets him at the tomb. Juliet is afraid that Romeo won't believe that she is sleeping and will come to her tomb. If she is dead, she won't have to worry about that. Juliet believes that Romeo will think she is dead. So basically, it keeps changing. There's no consistency, right? I mean, can you imagine if you ask a student what happened and you kept getting different answers, right? So this is, at the moment, one of the most impressive deep neural net that's trying to look through the keyhole like the monster did. And you get essentially nonsense. There's no meaning whatsoever. Okay.
What causes the changes in the sequence?
Because it's stochastic. In other words, it's basically probabilistic. Each time you ask the machine to do it, as is, it was never asked before. Right.
So the machine does not learn from its previous.
No, it's not being trained here. Right. This is when it's at steady state. Right. And this is like AlphaGo, this is like chess. There's no meaning, there's no semantics in any of this, right? So all the AI at the moment is incredibly intelligent and incredibly dumb at the same time. I mean, this is impressive, and the sentence completion is really impressive. But there's no Frankenstein's monster in here, right? Now I'm going to show you a video of the motor part, just so you get a feel for where we are in terms of robots. Is the volume up? Can you turn the volume up? I'll stop it. You don't really need volume, but it's fun to hear it. Who's responsible? I was told that somebody else would put up the volume over here. Yeah, but you can't control that here. Oh, maybe I can. It's just that I can't turn it up. Okay. So this is Boston Dynamics, and this is the Atlas robot. Okay, sorry about that.
World.
Sorry, it was my fault.
The answer is, of course, Atlas robot from Boston Dynamics.
Pretty impressive, right? I mean, this is...
The world's most dynamic humanoid robot, Atlas, is a research platform designed to push the limits of whole-body mobility. Atlas's advanced control system and state-of-the-art hardware give the robot the power and balance to demonstrate human-level agility. Atlas's advanced control system...
And this bounding is what Dr. Frankenstein saw the monster doing in the Alps, right? Jumping these huge distances up
the whole body
the Alps.
And environment to plan movements.
I mean, it's a bit scary in a way, right? Right? Anyway, look, and very, very... this is doing its planning. In other words, it knows the distances, it knows the heights. It can do that. It can even do this. Oh, wait, we'll see in a minute. That's higher than we can go. So this is very much like the monster. It's powerful, and it does a backflip. Look at that. I'm very proud of itself. Okay. Now... What are you thinking now? So are we ahead when it comes to the motor side? Well, not really. I mean, it's not really dexterous with its hands, and you probably wouldn't want to tango with that robot or go dancing with it. Okay. So at the moment, that's the most advanced robot we have, and you saw what GPT-3 and other neural networks are doing. So in other words, we're really not close to what Dr. Frankenstein made. We're just not. Okay. So why not? Well, there's a big debate right now in AI, which you could argue Mary Shelley kind of guessed at, which is that to get artificial general intelligence, this holy grail of the AGI, not just domain-specific, what's called narrow AI, but general intelligence like Frankenstein's monster had. You need a body that moves and feels. In other words, you can't just be a computer like AlphaGo or a brain in a vat. You need a body that moves and feels. And many people are arguing that if we're going to get to artificial general intelligence, we're going to have to give the computer a body as well. It's an embodied intelligence. A childhood. The computer's going to have a childhood, even a miserable one like the monster did. A lot of innate structure and reasoning, inference, which is not present in the AI currently.
What about emotion?
Well, yes. I mean, at the moment, emotion is not being really, it's the third tier at the moment.
Reasoning without emotion?
Oh, that's a huge topic. I think so, yes. I think you can do... There are psychological constraints due to emotion on how humans do inference, but I think there can be emotionless inference. So I would see it more as that we have to cope. And so there's a very interesting link between human psychology, ethics, and AI, because maybe we just can't help but get emotional, like the monster, right? The monster was very intelligent, but just couldn't control his emotions, right? So I would argue right now, current robots plus deep learning are not going to get us there anytime soon. Don't believe the hype, okay? But there are other issues. Let's see. What is more likely? Well, cyborgs are more likely. So what's the difference between an android and a cyborg? Well, an android is something like Frankenstein's monster that is created out of pieces. The original robots, by the way, were not made out of metal. They were made out of some strange fleshy substance. The word was introduced and means worker in Czech in the 1920s. Okay. But cyborgs are when it's us with enhancements. Okay. So that's what Frankenstein version 2.0 is. It's Dr. Octopus, right? It's a human plus appendages. This is coming. This is actually the monster that Mary Shelley didn't imagine. But it's actually the monster, if it's a monster, that we'll have first. Okay. It's this. Okay. So there's a whole field now of neurotechnology accelerating to enhance humans after injury or disease. Now, you might argue that's not enhancement because the best you might be able to do is to bring the person back to normality. It's like Freud, right? He said, my job is to just make you unhappy in an ordinary way. Right? And, you know, there's deep brain stimulation for Parkinson's disease. This is really effective for, you know, in some patients who have no longer got responsiveness to drugs, right? And so this is something that we're doing. We're also doing this for pain. It's beginning to be thought about for depression. And then we have all sorts of exoskeletons and other devices to try and enhance strength in patients who have lost, for example, ambulation. So this Dr. Octopus-flavored Frankenstein is already here. Now, I'm just going to tell you about two cases that I'm myself working on. So this is, we're now putting a stimulator into the cervical cord. Neurosurgeons put it in to stimulate the cervical cord of patients with chronic stroke. So here the idea is that the stroke has affected a significant percentage of the descending pathways to the spinal cord, but the spinal cord is intact. So the idea is maybe that if you increase the quality of the signal coming from the residual pathways in the brain down to the spinal cord, you can augment its quality of control. And in fact, that's exactly what we are finding. Right? It's very exciting. We've done three patients so far. It's led by Marco Capogrosso at the University of Pittsburgh, you know, and I'm involved. So this is where you could imagine a patient having electrodes permanently put into their neck, and you just go home and you say, turn stimulator on, right? You've become you're a cyborg. That's happening, we're doing it. What about healthy humans, though? Is there something wrong with enhancing somebody who isn't sick, who isn't injured? Okay. So I can just tell you a story about something that happened to me. We published a paper back in 2009 where we did a form of stimulation externally to make people better at learning a simple motor skill. A very simple skill. You basically hold a little force transducer and you have to squeeze very finely, and it's non-linear, so the relationship isn't obvious, and you have to move the cursor back and forth. So you have to go from here to one, stop, go back, two, stop, and you can't do that and overshoot because then you lose the whole trial. It's actually quite hard, right? And then you can practice this over many, many, many days and just see if you get better. One of the big mysteries in neuroscience is how do you get better with practice? We still don't know, actually, right? But nevertheless, we can see if we can enhance it without knowing it, right? And then what you can do is you can locate with brain imaging and something called transcranial magnetic stimulation the location of your motor cortex, which is the region on this side, controls this side of the body. And then you can start stimulating over that piece of motor cortex and try and enhance skill learning. Right? These are healthy people just practicing with and without this piece of stimulation. All right? And it's quite dramatic. In other words, this is what happens if learning over days if you don't do it, and this is what happens if you do. And I'm not going to go through the whole study, but these gains remain many, many months later. Okay. Is this okay?
Do they ever go away, those skills that are in...
We haven't been able... I mean, we didn't follow that long, but it can be there even a year later. So it's a very local skill. This is a very artificial task. But is this like Lance Armstrong taking drugs to win the Tour de France? Would it be worse if he secretly put a battery on his head while he was practicing? And then you have to ask yourself, well, what's actually wrong with it? I mean, if you have a better coach, or you have a better bike, or you have better sports equipment, isn't that cheating also? So it's a very interesting ethical space of what happens when drugs and neurotechnology start to enhance normal, healthy people. But as I said, the question is Frankenstein version 2, like version 1, offending nature now rather than God? And you have a lot of this. Is this not natural? It's against human nature, right? What I would say is people in this field now, philosophers and otherwise, talk of human nature and what is natural is essentially useless to actually make fine-grained cost-benefit analyses as each neurotechnology comes along. Okay, it has become apparent that appeals to human nature and the like are too vague and ideologically fraught to aid in ethical arguments about human biomedical enhancement. You need to take it case by case and actually construct a cost-benefit argument. General appeals to something more nebulous are useless and could be applied to many other human enhancers like books, schools, hot water, and iPhones. And every technology that comes along, by the way, is attacked. Right? Going all the way back to Plato and books, phones, television, it's hilarious to go and see how these are all attacked. All right. Now, to finish, we've talked about Frankenstein version 1, which is AI, robots, where are we? We've talked about Frankenstein version 2, which is the cyborgian enhancement of us, right, in health and disease. And now the final thing that we have to worry about is what about us being controlled from the outside or having our thoughts read? In other words, the big concern now is, are we at risk of losing our thoughts as private thoughts? Okay. And kind of yes. Not right now, but this is just an article in The New Yorker about this work that's now being done where you can literally use functional MRI to begin to decode what movie you're watching, whether you're lying or not, what dream you had, right? And these are above chance decoding. Okay? Now, no one's going to run up to you and plonk an MRI on you, right? But there are other non-invasive, more portable ways to do it. Okay? Let me give you an example. This is just a headband that uses something called near-infrared, and it can be used as a lie detector. Now, it's not perfect. I'm not overhyping these things. I'm just saying, this is already here. All right. And what we want to avoid is what this other set of movies are about, right? The Manchurian Candidate is a classic, Get Out, right? Which was a basically losing your body to someone else's control. I very much recommend this movie. And now this series that has just come out called Severance, where your memory at work and your memory at home are severed, so you have no idea who you are when you're at work.
Sounds familiar, right? But these films, you know, you can always sort of imagine whether it's Mary Shelley or whether it's HBO, they're picking up on something before it happens, right? And you think not? Well, let me show you a real example. This is in China, where children wear these EEG headbands, and then the teacher checks to see whether they're concentrating or not. Right? Now, this caused a bit of an uproar, thank God, right? But this is happening.
You want to suggest it for the audience?
Well, I can tell already that I've lost them ages ago. So, I hope you can see that for Mary Shelley, there are many, many things hiding in there if you read it. And it's not just a horror story about a monster. Then it wouldn't be interesting at all. We wouldn't still be reading it. We're reading it because it's got all of this in it. Okay. And there's a concern now that this is going to require a new set of human rights. And Rafa Yuste and a group at Columbia University have come up with the five neuro rights. Okay, and you can see them. Personal identity. Under no circumstances may neurotechnology alter a person's sense of self. Free will. People must be able to make decisions freely without neurotechnological manipulation. Mental privacy. Data on people's brain activity may not be used without consent. Equal access. This is something that comes up all the time, which is if you're going to be enhanced, then it shouldn't just be the rich that become superhuman and everyone else is now at their mercy. And then protection against biases. And this is this whole notion that these technologies can simply perpetuate the usual sexism and racism that we still suffer under today. And Chile is the first country to actually pass a bill of neuro rights in its government, in its parliament. Okay, I don't know why it's Chile. But it's coming. Now, there are philosophers who think that you don't need this and that these are too porous. I'm not going to discuss that today. But I just want you to know that from 1818, when that first science fiction novel was written by Mary Shelley, here we are over 200 years later. We have all those movies, all these pieces that are very much catalyzed by that book, and we're ending right here with this. And I think that this is something we should be worrying about before we think that we're going to be taken over by replicants or AIs or Terminators. And I'll stop there. Thanks.